Right, the Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications Committee will be in order. Today, we're going to have an overview of the governor's recommendations, and we're going to start with the Public Utilities Commission. Welcome, Dr. Haar.
Chair.
And obviously, let's see, we do have a handout, members. PUC, so we could start with that.
All right. Madam Chair, thank you very much. And members, my name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Public Utilities Commission. I should mention that Chairman David Boyd is out of state on business, on commission business today, and our Thursdays are meeting days for the commission, and they were hard at it when we left, yet they had a rather long agenda today. So we won't have any commissioners present, but I'm sure they'll be here in spirit. So with that, I'll delve into our budget overview. We had the opportunity about a month ago, I think it was maybe a little over that, to when Chairman Boyd came before you and gave a pretty comprehensive overview of what the commission does. So I'm not going to dwell a lot on that today. I'll probably go through some quick reminders, but then get to the budget issues fairly quickly, if that's all right.
Sure, absolutely.
So what does the commission do? As I'm sure you all recall, we regulate the major electricity, natural gas, and local telephone companies in Minnesota. These are cornerstone industries. Slide here gives you a little bit of information about the nature of the industry here in the state. The industry is, the industries, I should say, are certainly significant. They have a major impact on the state's economy. Total gross operating revenues are in the neighborhood of $7.5 billion annually, and employment is over 22,500, according to the most recent estimate from the Department of Employment, Minnesota Department of Employment. Our statutory mission is to ensure safe, adequate, and reliable services at fair and reasonable rates. That's been sort of our bedrock charge in statute for many years. As of 2005, authority for approval of sites or routes of large energy facilities that are in the public interest was transferred from the Environmental Quality Board to the Public Utilities Commission, so we've had that responsibility since 2005. And also, we have responsibility over local telephone service, and our primary responsibility in that area is to foster effective competition now, because that industry is largely deregulated in the state and across the nation, for that matter. Our budget is a pretty simple one compared to what I'm sure you'll be seeing from Commerce and probably other agencies that you oversee. The biggest chunk, by far the biggest chunk of it, is general fund, 73% here, based on this this pie chart. I should mention that probably close to 95%, 93 to 95% of that is consists of salaries and rent. So we're largely, we don't have other programs. It's largely the commission staff and the space that we occupy. If you add in technology, it's a much bigger percentage. And also, I should mention that virtually all of our expenditures under that general fund category are recovered through assessments. We have assessment authority. The utilities that come before us are charged for the services, basically, that we provide. So it's not quite 100%. It's about, I think, in the neighborhood of 97-98% of our general fund budget is returned to the general fund. We also have a couple of special revenue funds. By far the largest component of that piece of the pie there is the telephone assistance program. That is a program that provides discount service to families that qualify for various low-income programs that that are in need of help with maintaining their local telephone service. Of course, that's funded through a special charge on telephone bills. And the commission has responsibility to administer that fund to make sure that the funds are properly recorded and that the credits go back to the telephone companies commensurate with the credits that they're providing to consumers. And also the commission has responsibility for setting the amount of that charge. This is something that we review several times a year and to determine, you know, whether or not the current charge, I believe it's 7 cents, I should have checked that, I believe it's 7 cents per line per month, is adequate to fund what the program needs. And also we look at the eligibility and the projected needs, the number of households that are likely to be affected. This program, I should mention, for a few years, several years ago, went through some sort of oscillations because it's tied in with a similar federal program, and the eligibility requirements in our state program are tied in with the federal program, and those standards were changing. So it was affecting the number of households that were eligible, and there was a fair amount of uncertainty because of uncertainty with the eligibility requirements. That I'm happy to say that's really settled down, and those numbers are pretty predictable right now, assuming everything stays as is. I should also,
Dr. Hart,
yes,
on that special revenue fund. It would be interesting to know where those figures are at, how much the commission is collecting on that, and if that is projected to change because of the high usage of people taking off their main line and just using their cell phone. And so I would assume that there is not going to be that great need for assistance for main lines.
Madam Chair. Just handed a sheet here that provides the total revenue for TAP for the is this just the TAP or is this the other fund too, Marcia? Yeah, the amount is in the fund is it's for fiscal year 2011. It's $2,408,000 is the total amount in there. Now, that may not all be TAP because there's another piece of the special revenue fund which has to do with our Office of Administrative Hearings, which is a very small percentage of it. But the vast majority of that is for the telephone assistance program. And the changes that have occurred in terms of use of cell phones and so on has had an impact. Landlines usage has gone down somewhat. I don't know right off the top of my head what impact that has had on families that are eligible, that meet the eligibility requirements, the low-income families, the extent to which they're using cell phones as a substitute for local landlines. It may, but I can look into that further and get back to the committee on that.
Dr. Herr, I think that's a really interesting. It's a dilemma or a situation that's happening all over the United States, as we know. I mean, there's some countries out there that don't even have main lines or landlines. They've all gone to cell phone uses. And in fact, several of my family members have dropped their landline, and they're just using their cell phone. So I'd assume, if I may, the telephone assistance program is just for landlines. Is that
yes.
correct?
Yes, it is.
So it would be nice to know how many they have served in the past, what's the projection going forward, and how, if you can find, the percentage of people that are dropping their landline phones to cell phones, and what are you projecting? Because, of course, this program is not going to be used for the cell phones.
Right.
It would be just for the landline. So this is,
what you're interested in is the impact of the cell phone usage on that.
Right. And then also, what is the Office of Administrative Hearings? What does that do?
Office of Administrative Hearings, that's the other small component of this. They are the office that run our evidentiary hearing process. When the commission has a matter that comes before it that where the parties are disputing facts, accuracy of facts, like in a rate case, it almost invariably happens in a rate case where a company will make a filing claiming it's entitled to a certain amount of money, and there's, you know, incredible filing requirements that go along with that. The parties, Office of Energy Security and other parties, will take a look at that, and they'll say, wait a minute, you know, we don't agree with some of these numbers. So when that happens, then the commission routinely refers the matter to the Office of Administrative Hearings. And the Office of Administrative Hearings then runs the process that that builds the record for the case. They will conduct all of the public hearings that are done in conjunction with major proceedings, rate cases and certificate of need filings and transmission line filings, all of those kinds of things, as well as the evidentiary hearings. There are two different kinds of hearings, you may recall from Chair Boyd's presentation. The public hearings is where the general public can come in and basically have their say about whatever is being proposed, whether it's a rate increase or a transmission line or whatever. And then the evidentiary hearings are where the formal parties to the proceeding, those that actually, you know, have a financial interest in the case, come before the administrative law judge and present their testimony, present their witnesses. They're subject to cross-examination. It's an adversarial process. It's a trial. It's run very just like a court trial. And from that, the record then is developed and presented back to the commission for its recommendation, with a recommendation, and the commission can accept that recommendation or it can reach its own conclusion. It's the commission's ultimate decision that counts, I guess you could say, but certainly that we rely to a significant degree on the Office of Administrative Hearings for development of the formal record, because it's on the basis of the formal record, of course, that the commission needs to make its decisions. So they play a very, very critical role in what we do. In most states, in a lot of states, Office of Administrative Hearings or an administrative hearing function is part of the commission. They're one agency. In Minnesota, we tend to split things up more. They're in a separate office, and this arrangement works just fine. I'm not critical of the structure of it. It's the way it's done, but it's a very integral service to what we have to do as a commission.
I see.
And that's a revolving fund. That's about $400,000, I believe.
Mr. Jensen.
Madam Chair and members, just a bit of background information. The budget page handout is in your packet, and the numbers that Mr. Haar is explaining is on page 13. You have GC buying a budget in your pack. Useful as you review this and decide on the appropriation numbers.
All right. Madam Chair, do you want me to proceed?
Yes. Well, one more question, Dr. Haar. And that special revenue fund, you're not locked into 22%. Has that historically been your percentage in the past? And I would assume those funds can be maneuvered throughout the commission.
Yeah. Madam Chair, well, no, the funds are dedicated to that purpose. I mean, they can only be used for the credits, to fund the credit, to reimburse the companies for the credits they provide to customers. So, no, that's a dedicated fund. It's a special fund. It's not something that we use. We charge off, I think, a 0.3 FTE against that fund for the amount of time our budget people, accounting people, and some of our rate analysts spend managing that fund. But it doesn't take a great deal of our time. At this point, it's monitoring the number of households that are eligible, developing the spreadsheets that look at, you know, is the charge the right charge or does it need to be adjusted? And as I say, the commission has a proceeding on this a couple of times a year where we'll look at it and occasionally we'll make adjustments in either the charge, if that is appropriate, or at times it's also changed the amount of the benefit, the actual amount of the credit that the households receive. It can do both. But it is something we're constantly reviewing. It does, as I say, it doesn't take a great deal of our time, but we do charge off a portion of an FTE to cover those costs.
And what are the program's guidelines mirrored off of? I mean, what guidelines do you run with? The LIHEAP program, or as far as
Madam Chair, it is tied into existing programs of that nature that are income-dependent, LIHEAP, and other programs of that nature. I don't have the full list here. I can certainly provide that, a list of programs, but it's tied into existing programs.
Okay. And Dr. Haar, too, if you could find out if there's a running balance, excess balance in that historically, that would be nice.
I will do so.
Thank you.
Right. Our priorities for use of our budget generally are listed on the next slide. I guess I'm on slide six here. Obviously, issuing informed decisions, orders, is kind of our main business. So informed, timely, and clearly articulated decisions that are consistent with statutory mission. We also have a consumer affairs office that deals with thousands of consumer complaints every year. That's an important part of how we use our budget resources. When we were here in January, Chairman Boyd talked about the Midwest Independent System Operator and all of the things going on a regional and national basis now, particularly in electricity. That's a fairly new area of responsibility for us since about 2005, and that takes an increasing amount of time. Also, we strive to provide information, public access to information on the Commission's activities. We have the ability to do that electronically. I'll talk about this a little bit more in just a minute. And then also, like every other state agency, we want to maintain a stable staff, a productive staff, staff that's aware and up to speed on current issues. And also, we're all, like every other agency, we're dealing with the baby boom phenomenon. So that's another issue.
Dr. Haar, Senator Jungbauer.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Haar, thinking about the consumer inquiries and complaints, and I'll kind of put three different sort of questions out there to see, you know, if you can kind of answer it, or maybe we can get more information on this, but number one, how much time you think is actually spent in terms of FTE or time? Are there certain categories that every complaint or inquiry tends to fall under? And is there any way that we can provide, I don't know, information or something in a more user-friendly way that would avoid staff time and do something more online? Is there other ways that we could lessen the cost of the consumer inquiries and complaints? So kind of three different things, but they may all roll into one.
Dr. Haar.
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we have four FTE in our Consumer Affairs Office. They handle about, I think the most recent figure was like 17,000 calls a year, in the neighborhood of 3,000 to 4,000 complaints. Most of the complaints have to do with billing issues or service problems. They get calls on just about everything, I can assure you, and I'm sure you're familiar with that phenomenon. But I would say the vast majority deal with billing complaints, billing errors, or problems with service, that sort of thing. Sometimes people are just looking for information, about their services. So it's a broad spectrum, but I would say those would be the main categories, and we do put a great deal of effort into our web page. In fact, the manager of the Consumer Affairs Office was tasked several years ago with upgrading and revamping our web page to do exactly what I think your question is getting at, which was to make it more user-friendly, make it more accessible, get things up front that people are mostly interested in. And we spent a fair amount of time looking at and tracking what people were asking about and looking at on our webpage. We made some very significant revisions to that, and that's a kind of a constant improvement process that we have going there. But we've taken measures to do that. But I'd be happy to provide further information if you like.
Senator Jumba.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Dr. Haar, so you've not internally figured out any other ways that we could get more information out to the public or lessen these amount of complaints or inquiries?
Madam Chair, Senator Jungbauer, we do offer a fair amount of information to the public. I guess it's a matter of helping the public understand it when they need to understand it. And for example, in a rate case, there is a formal public notice that has to be sent out. Utility will present that. All the parties look at it. Typically, our consumer affairs office will be the ones to make final revisions on it, and so that it's understandable to consumers, it says the right things, it provides the relevant information. That is sent out on, as part of a billing process, the monthly bills. We oftentimes put information about major filing like that on our rate case so people are aware. Same with our public hearing processes for major facilities. Information is sent out to local municipalities, local media's outlets. If it's a case where we know who the landowners are, we'll send information to landowners. It's getting them to pay attention to it. That's kind of the key. I hate to say it, but it's true. This is an issue for us. We're constantly striving to figure out how to do that. Those are the kinds of measures that we've adopted so far.
Okay, thank you. So,
now, I advance this. I haven't figured out how to make this go in reverse. I'm going to do this. The most pressing budget issues for us are staff resources. It's our managing our workload. And I'll talk more about that in a little more detail in just a minute. But that's clearly far and away the largest issue for us. Managing a growing and more complex, more diverse workload. As I said, we've relied a lot on trying to make things more accessible electronically, and we've integrated the use of electronic data management to a significant degree because we've had to in order to be able to keep up with our workload. We have to use technology as effectively as we can. Plus, as I indicate here, we want to be as transparent as we can. And then finally, developing staff for the longer term. I might mention that nearly 20% of the commission staff is at or within 5 years of being eligible for the rule of 90. So we're at a point where a significant amount of senior staff members are, starting to think about retiring, and there's a major sort of shift that's going to take place. So we're trying to build bench strength, I guess you could say, and training and finding talented people is been a major focus for us. As I said, the major issue affecting operations is our workload. We typically have around 1,800 to 2,000 filings a year, sometimes a little more than that. Recent year, it's been in the 1,900 range. That's been fairly sustained over the last few years. And the thing that's really different about it is that the nature of the filings has changed. They're becoming far more complicated, more diverse. The addition of the permitting processes has brought in a considerably new dimension for us. So the complexity of the filings has intensified, and it's taken more time. And what's listed on this slide here is just to show you four different categories of filings. These are just four of, a lot of different types of filings that we have, but these four are the four types of filings that take the most time, most commission time, the most commission staff time. The general rate case, GR, is for the general rate case. The IRP is the integrated resource planning process. CN is certificate of need. And then the siting is the siting and routing of large energy facilities. Currently, we have four active rate cases going on, and we have several other in compliance stages. Resource plans are filed every 2 years, and so we're on a just sort of a continual treadmill on that. Certificate of need, we have six certificate of need cases currently active before the commission. These are mostly transmission lines, I believe. And then siting and routing or route permit cases, we have 18 that are currently pending. So you can see that as of 2005, things started ramping up, and that's, of course, when the authority over this permitting process was transferred from the EQB to the commission. So it's understandable that it would be. But this is only part of the picture because, as I said, we still have 1,800 to 2,000 filings every year. So we get lots of other things dealing with rate riders. You've heard a bit about that. Depreciation, mergers, service area disputes, fuel clause adjustments, to name just a few. So we have to manage all of that in addition to these other larger, more major projects. All of this takes time. All of it takes energy. It takes energy, too, but it also takes staff resources for sure.
Madam Chair.
Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, but Mr. Hart, I was wondering if you could just go back to that that slide that had the four different rate cases on it there. And just to put it in context a little bit, can you just tell the committee approximately how many months each one of these take, and that I think that might be helpful.
Okay, thank you for that question, Senator
Dr.
and Madam
Hunt.
Chair. Yes, by statute, the commission must render a decision in a general rate filing in 10 months. And it takes all of that 10 months to go through the process because the process involves the public initial filing, setting interim rates, which happens in the first couple of months. Then we get into the public hearings, party submission of testimony, the evidentiary hearings, the ALJ report, and then it's handed off back to the commission. As you may recall, in 2009, I believe it was, commission came forward and said, we're having a very difficult time meeting that 10-month deadline because we're getting so many rate cases. We're getting more than what we've seen in the past. And as some of you will recall, we were able to get authority to extend that 10-month deadline period up to an additional 90 days. And that was with the support of the utilities and all the parties, so that was much appreciated. That has helped tremendously. I should say that we have to extend it almost every time now. I mean, we're at a point where we have to extend it every time; otherwise, we're gonna have a problem. So we don't always extend it all the way up to the full 90 days, but quite often we do, and in almost every case we have to do some extension. So the answer to your question is the minimum time period would be 10 months. And it could be up to, 12, 13. And these are cases of involving complex corporate financial issues, and they impact people in a major way, as we know, especially in these times. So they're difficult proceedings.
Dr. Har, as the most of those sightings.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Madam Chair, yeah, just to, I know the certificate of need takes quite a while, too, if an OES is, I should say environmental impact statement is, EIS is done. OES kind of takes care of that, but
yes.
I'm just wondering if you could speak to the other categories there, too.
Madam Chair, yes, Senator, I'm sorry. The certificate of need and siting proceedings if they're simple, non-controversial, we've done them as quickly as 6 months. If they're controversial, which most of the big ones are, it's usually 12 months, and they have to be out in 12 months. That's the statutory deadline. And then the integrated resource planning is, there isn't really a set schedule, there isn't a statutory due date on that, but as I said, they're filed on a biennial basis, and we've got the utilities on a staggered schedule, so we don't get all of them at once. That would be horrific. But that's a sort of an ongoing process, but that's usually a year and a half process before we really kind of get to the end of that. Some of them take longer than that if there are change circumstances that affect their resource needs, that kind of thing. So these are not quick turnaround kinds of proceedings, these four. Now, I should also add that the other filings, many of the other filings, vast majority of the other filings are dealt with in 60, 90 days, probably. You know, if they're not controversial, routine, we go through our review processes and we get them before the commission as quickly as we can and out the door and try to, without holding things up. So I'm happy to say that not everything takes that amount of time, but the more complicated ones do.
And are the sightings, the 18 sightings, are those mostly wind? What are those?
It's evenly split between wind generators. I even have a sheet here, I think, with them on. If you'll bear with me a moment. They're evenly split. The 19 are nine wind generating facilities. Right now, there are no other generating facilities in queue. It's all wind. And then the others are all transmission facilities. Yes. Yep. All right. About that. Oh, here I am again. Need to get reverse in this thing. All right. I talked about the Midwest ISO. Being a major commitment, and we could talk more about that. I think in our earlier hearing, we did get into that a little bit, and I'd reiterate, encourage the committee to hear more about that. I think it's something you really need to.
Well, Dr. Hart, we have a tour next Tuesday during this committee time. So
I understand that, Madam Chair, and I think that's a great start. There's a lot more detail to learn, but I think that would be a terrific start, and I'm glad to hear you're doing that.
We'll follow up then.
Very good. I should mention that this work that we're doing, we're doing it with a staff that is among the smallest in the country. Our staff, if you look at it on a per capita basis, and I've done this a few times now, and it varies a little bit, but the last time I did it, calculated our staff size per capita with other states, all 50 states, we came in 47th, just looking at just the PUC staff, 47th out of 50. If you throw in the folks over, our colleagues over at OES that work on utility regulatory matters, it bumps us all the way up to 41 or 42, I think. So we're in the bottom 20%, even though our population-wise, we're much closer to the middle. And this chart is just intended to kind of illustrate that. These are states that have populations that are within 500,000 one way or the other, Minnesota. So they're pretty comparable population-wise. And as you can see, their staff sizes are substantially higher. Some of them have additional responsibilities, I should add. They don't regulate just telephone, gas, and electricity. Some of them regulate water to a certain degree. Some of them regulate transport. I don't know if any of these regulate transportation. I don't think these are, but some regulate waste management, that kind of thing. But by and large, the vast majority of the responsibility is exactly the same as ours. By the way, the average, if you average the staff sizes of the states that I have here, it's 134 staff, FTE, 134. And if you added our staff of 42 with the folks at OES that do utility regulatory work, we'd probably be around 75 to 80, maybe. So we're substantially under the average. We're not overstaffed here in Minnesota. And that gets to the change item in our budget proposal. The proposal is to increase the operating budget of by $750,000 per year for fiscal year, $1.5 million for the biennium. And with that, those resources, we would anticipate adding 8 FTE devoted to expediting utility filings. That's where we need the help. And as I mentioned on here, and I guess I should have gotten into a little more detail a few slides ago on it. We've also been able to secure a temporary American Recovery and Reindustrialization Act grant. It's a grant that expires here at the end of this year. But with those resources, we added three temporary FTE in their engineering. They're in our permitting. So three of the eight that we would anticipate under the change proposal would be to retain those folks because they've been playing a key role in our permitting activities as well, as well as our involvement in the Midwest ISO. They've been very instrumental in that as well. So eight of the three would go to that, and then the remaining five would be a net increase beyond what we currently have over today. This would be funding. It'd be through the general fund, and therefore would be recoverable through our assessment process. And as I said, we recover virtually all of our expenditures and return it to the general fund. So I think that completes what I had anticipated talking about today. I hope that is complete enough, answers, gives you a good foundation for your review. I'll be happy to answer any questions, any additional questions you might have.
Dr. Haar, with the five new FTEs, will the utility filings be expedited? Back to Senator Howe's question. Will we be able to cut those down to
yes,
a reasonable amount of time?
Madam Chair, thank you for asking that. I should have mentioned that. Yes, I mean, obviously it's hard to quantify exactly how that will work out, but they will be devoted to utility filings, and my hope would be, and our hope is, that we wouldn't have to rely on the extensions as much. My hope would be that we can eliminate them. I don't know if that's going to be possible, but we certainly don't have to rely on them as much, and we can get back to more of a 10-month mode. I fully expect we'll be able to move in that direction. I also believe we'll be able to get written orders generated more quickly. Right now we have five attorneys working in that area. That's pretty much exclusively their job, but they cover all of these different areas on 2,000 filings a year. That's a lot of orders. Mm-hmm. And adding another person there would help tremendously in getting those orders out. Orders on really complicated cases always are difficult because they have to be defensible in court, and so we have to be careful about how they're written and make sure they're accurate and reflect what the commission did and so on. So, it takes time, but generally orders should come out more quickly. Just generally, I think we'll be able to cover more ground.
Are there any other questions from the committee? Thank you so much, Dr. Haar.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. You did a great job. Even without
that. Thank you.
Wonderful. Director Grant and Mr. Jenke, please come up. Welcome, Director Grant.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I know this. I've only been on the job 3 weeks.
Okay, that's not going to cut it anymore,
you're,
right?
You're the program.
I know. That excuse is worn thin already, I'm afraid. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Bill Grant for the Department of Commerce. And what we like to do this afternoon with the help of our CFO, Tim Jenke, and a manager of our telecommunications unit, Diane Wells, is walk you through the Office of Energy Security and Telecom budgets within the Department of Commerce. I'm going to kick off with just a very high-level overview of the department. Then we're going to dive into the telecom unit. We're going to switch back to the energy functions and then take you through the budget numbers for each of those. First of all, Madam Chair and committee members, again, at the high level, the Department of Commerce ensures equitable commercial and financial transactions and reliable utility services. We do this by regulating and licensing business activities in more than 20 industries, investigating and resolving consumer complaints, advocating for the public interest before regulatory bodies, and delivering federal and state energy and telecommunications programs. And this is, as you can imagine, a very wide and diverse set of programs and issues that the department is charged with handling, and I'm just learning about all of those functions, although obviously had a pretty good awareness of the lion's share of it. I'm going to, at this point, turn it over to Mr. Jenke to start walking you through the budget, and then we're going to go to the telecom divisions.
Welcome, Mr. Jenke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Tim Jenke, CFO for the Department of Commerce. Just on the bottom of the of your front page, basically, we just have handouts. We're not walking through a PowerPoint here, so the members should have those. On the bottom, under the mission statement here, is information, basically trying to give the big picture. Obviously, much of what the Department of Commerce does isn't within the purview of this committee, but we wanted to kind of give the sense of where the funds reside. You can see here that the big part of this pie chart, about 76% of the agency spending, is the Office of Energy Security. Under 1% is the telecom program, and 2% is the TAM program. We'll basically be diving down deeper later on here on those three slices of the pie. And I'll have Diane talk about a few of the telecom mission here.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Diane Wells, and I'm manager of the Telecom Division, as indicated. And as you can see from page 2 of the handout, the mission of the Telecom Division is to provide decision makers with appropriate information and policy alternatives that are responsive to changing market conditions and support the provision of reliable retail and wholesale telecommunications services at fair and reasonable rates, terms, and conditions. And when we talk about the regulated telecommunications industry in Minnesota, we're referring to the landline telephone service provided by what we call the incumbent local telephone companies, and there are about 95 of those in Minnesota, and the competitive local exchange carriers, or CLECs, and there are about 200 of those, and then also the intrastate long-distance service providers, and I think there are about 300 of those certified in the state. The Public Utilities Commission is the body that makes the regulatory decisions for the regulated telecommunications industry and has its own advisory staff. The Department of Commerce Telecommunications Division is the advocate for the public interest in proceedings before the commission, reviews routine filings, and also conducts investigations on telecommunications issues on its own or as directed by the commission. With regard to the telecommunications industries, the Department of Commerce's regulatory responsibilities are generally devoted to the following. All regulated telephone companies are required to keep current rates on file, so we review and process these filings. The Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996 gave the states the responsibility for overseeing the interconnection agreements between the companies, and so we review these agreements and intervene as a party when the two interconnecting companies cannot reach agreement or have a dispute regarding an existing agreement. And this would be an example, if it's highly disputed, it would go in front of an ALJ with the OAH to make a recommendation to the commission, and we're a party to those proceedings. All new entrants to the market must be certified, and again, these are landline wired companies. So we review these applications to determine if the company has the financial, managerial, and technical ability to provide service. All companies that are certified also must have on file 911 plans, tariffs, and interconnection agreements, so we review those. Carriers wishing to obtain public subsidies from the Federal Universal Service Fund must be certified annually by the Commission, and the Department conducts that investigation and makes recommendations. Consumer complaints regarding telephone service, as Dr. Haar indicated, are reviewed by the or handled by the Consumer Affairs Office at the PUC. But if it's an indication of a systemic problem, then it'll be handed over to the Department for investigation. And we also investigate many other types of filings by the companies, like promotions that they might have to their end user customers, rate or term changes, boundary changes, and service availability. Within the telecom division, we also oversee the Telecommunications Access Minnesota, or TAM, program. And that's the relay program and equipment distribution program. And TAM ensures that the communications impaired persons have an equal ability to use the telecommunications network. Finally, the Department of Commerce also has a role with regard to broadband service. We are responsible for reporting annually on the state's progress towards meeting the broadband goals established last year in statute, and we are the state agency partner to Connected Nation, which is mapping broadband in Minnesota and also doing survey research work. And you might note that the work of Connected Nation was compiled by the federal government in the national broadband map that was released last week. That's a real quick overview of the work we do within the division, and if you look at page 3 of 10, the TAM budget is more specifically provided there. And Mr. Jenke, I can answer any questions if you have any at this time.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Senator Howe.
Madam Chair, if you could just speak a little bit to the relay service there. I'm just wondering with technology today, I mean, every cell phone now, you know, will convert voice to text. I should say just virtually, just about everyone. Mm-hmm. What's the future hold there? What's the with the youth of technology, what does that budget forecast look going forward?
Ms. Wells.
Madam Chair, Senator Howe, I don't think we've done a 5-year or 10-year budget projection, but we do have an interagency agreement with the Department of Human Services that does the equipment distribution, and they distribute wireless equipment. I mean, this is a program that helps provide equipment to lower income individuals that otherwise might not be able to afford it. So they're very engaged in the technology to make sure it's as easy as possible for the communications impaired industry to use a telephone and to communicate with the non-communications impaired.
Thank you, Ms. Wells.
Madam Chair, I go back to page 2 real quick, and I just wanted, there's a chart there that outlines the telecoms, strictly the telecom division's expenditures for the coming biennium of just over $1 million a year. That funds about 8.5 FTE in the telecom division. The interesting thing to note there, similar to what Dr. Haar mentioned for the PUC, the telecom division assesses those costs out to the regulated utilities, and it really has a net zero impact on the general fund. In addition to that, the governor's budget did not propose any changes in this area, so spending from biennium to biennium, from 10 to 11, 12 to 13 is constant in that area. Moving on to page 3, you can see the TAM budget's laid out here. Of the total $12.8 million in expenditures for the coming biennium, $369,000 is for administration, administrative activities. That basically funds 1.5 FTE plus additional back office costs like rent and supplies and those types of things. Biennium to biennium, looking at 10 to 11, to 12 and 13, the 12-13 numbers are about a 4.6% reduction in those costs.
Mr. Jenke?
Yeah.
Senator Dunbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jenke. As some of the questions came up, Senator Howe, and as I'm thinking through some of the questions and from the Madam Chair, Does anyone in the department actually look at, as we're looking at the different agencies that are responsible for different portions of this, and as technology comes online, is there anybody that's ever looking at, can we eliminate things, can we move to different programs, can we combine things, or is this something that really we don't have time to do, or not the right talent sitting there to do that kind of analysis?
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Youngbauer, we do track, I believe, and Diane can confirm this, we do track from year to year the usage of the relay service and the equipment distribution. We know from dollar values, you know, how much is being used. And I think the use of the relay service this year, I think, has been down a bit because of use of other technologies. When that happens, generally what happens, we'll go before the surcharge that is the individual rate payer or the folks pay on their phone bills. We go before the PUC with basically a reduction then to have less resources. As far as completely combining programs or looking at TAP, I guess I'm not sure if that discussion has happened before.
Madam Chair.
Ms. Wells?
Thank you, Madam.
It looked like you wanted to talk.
Oh, Madam Chair, Senator Youngbauer. We do work somewhat closely with public safety as well because of 911 fee collections, and the change in technology isn't impacting so much the usage of the program, but the fee collection, as we see subscribers moving from wireless or wireline phones to VoIP technology, we see our numbers going down from whom we can collect the fee from, and I think there's also a prepaid wireless bill that's been introduced this session, so you'll get some idea of how that impacts the fee collection as well. But that's kind of the impact.
Senator Junkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Janke or whoever can answer this. And that actually answered part of my question, because as we move to different things, I'm actually a co-author on that prepaid bill because I see part of those problems. But does anyone in the office or PUC maybe for that, could answer part of that? Does anybody meet with industry people and look at where the projections are going in terms of technology, what kind of things are coming up so that we can plan and implement those kind of new changes?
Madam Chair, Senator Youngbauer, you know, we're a regulatory body, so we regulate the landline phone companies, so we see those landlines going down. So in terms of evaluating what the future holds, it is specifically generally for the TAMTAP and the 911 program that we would do that evaluation for. And there are issues, but I don't think public safety is ready yet to talk about a fee that might be a per-number fee collected or some other type of mechanism to collect the fees.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members, I think that might be something we need to look at is finding the right agency to take a look at that technology and see what's coming online to see, you know, how long some of these expenditures or different assignments at different departments might be valuable to the taxpayers. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Wells. Director Gant.
Madam Chair, turning now to the next slide, give you a bit of a more in-depth overview of the Office of Energy Security. And our role here is to provide reliable, affordable, and environmentally sound energy for Minnesota citizens and businesses. And we really do see this, and I think previous incumbents in my position have also drawn this point that this is really a three-legged stool that we're trying to balance these many times complementary goals, but at times goals that would move us in different directions if we emphasized one over the other. So within the Office of Energy Security, we have five business units, and I'll start with the Energy Facilities Permitting Unit. That unit manages permitting the permitting process and develops environmental review record for siting and routing of large energy facilities. We're not the advocates before the PUC on siting and routing. We're more the group that develops the record for the commission to be able to resolve those matters once it gets to them. And we serve as technical staff to the PUC on these matters. The manager of our unit, Deborah Pyle, as a matter of fact, is representing the agency on one of these siting cases this afternoon. Otherwise, she would have been here with us. The State Energy Office is the primarily federally funded portion of the agency that promotes energy efficiency and renewable energy through energy financing programs, technical assistance, and public information. We deliver the Conservation Improvement Program, which we've had extensive discussions about in your committee, Madam Chair, the Weatherization Assistance Program, the federally funded Weatherization Assistance Program, the State Energy Program, which is largely federally funded, and the Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant Programs, which, again, are federal funds. We have our low-income home energy assistance program, and as you've been looking at your budget sheets, you'll notice that that is by far and away the largest source of funding for the agency. The important thing to understand about that, of course, is that very little of that money stays in our office. For the most part, that money goes out to a network of deliverers of the program across the state, and that money in turn goes to energy providers across the state in the form of electric fund transfers once eligibility is determined for the program. Then we have our energy regulation and planning area, and this is the group that appears before the Public Utilities Commission on all matters that come before the commission, including rate cases, certificates of need, and resource planning cases. We are the analytical staff review and summarize these matters that come before the commission and provide recommendations reflecting the public interest perspective as the commission weighs those matters for a final decision. And then finally, administration and the reliability administrator. This was a provision that was added several years ago assist the state in making sure that energy reliability, particularly in the electric sector, is maintained. We're finding increasingly, as Dr. Hart pointed out, that this involves an increasingly complex set of policy decisions that are being made at the regional level by the Midwest Independent System Operator. And the role of the reliability administrator increasingly is to be the state's advocate in those discussions at the regional level.
Director Grant, you are going to go into the energy assistant program a little bit more, a little bit later.
Madam Chair, members, if you turn to page 5 of 10, the next page, this is basically a kind of a higher level flow chart of how the funding works in the Office of Energy Security. The blue area or the blue lines here indicate federal funding. Federal HHS, Department of HHS, provides the funding for our low-income heating program, and the U.S. Department of Energy provides funding for weatherization in the state energy program, funding within our state energy office. The green areas of the chart here indicate either special revenue or general funds. You can see starting on the left, the general fund. It funds primarily the State Energy Office, our energy planning area, and admin functions. Next is a special revenue account. We'll dive into all these in more detail, but this is just kind of try to get that high level. Is the energy facility permitting, which is special revenue. We have some kind of mixed use here with some of the Exxon dollars. We have RDF and SIP, and then our reliability administrator functions, which are all special revenue accounts. Turning to the next page, page 6 of 6. Overall, for the governor's budget for next biennium includes just over $420 million in spending in the Office of Energy Security. You can see from the chart on the left here, obviously that's primarily federal funds. These are all the pass-through dollars, so 84% of the funding comes from the federal sources. In addition to that, we have federal stabilization, which is the ARA funding. So if you add those two together, about 93% of the overall funding for our agency is federal funds. We have about $6.5 million in general funding and 23.9 in special revenue. The chart on the right is basically a different way to kind of slice the money, trying to identify who's receiving that. Of the five work units that Deputy Grant identified before, where are those funds going of that $420 million? You can see that the energy planning area has about 1%, about $4.7 million. Facility permitting just over 6. State Energy Office about 77.5, which is primarily federal funds. The reliability administrator and basically back office admin is just over $2 million. And then the big kahuna in the room is the energy assistance program at $330 million for the coming biennium.
Mr. Jenke, does having the SIP program in the State Energy Office, does that make sense, even though it is federally funded, having that program go through that office, is that appropriate?
Madam Chair, we do think it does. It's a function that is closely tied to the regulatory oversight work that we do across other areas of the office, particularly the regulatory unit, which is already evaluating utility integrated resource plans, and the SIP programs are very much tied to the resource plans in the sense that we view energy efficiency as a resource that needs to be considered as part of what the utilities are planning to use to meet their future load requirements. So having the SIP program within our unit, I think, provides great coordination of those two endeavors.
And Mr. Grant, could you say again what was in the special revenue for $24 million?
Madam Chair, members, the funding that's in that special revenue account is, we have in there are the SIP assessment, so we assess the utilities for the SIP for research and development grants and for some other projects in there. We have a residential propane account, and then we have a variety of accounts, kind of some remnants from the RDF appropriations from prior legislative sessions. RDF funds were set aside for some specific projects. Those generally all end here in fiscal 12, so those accounts don't carry over anymore, and we're expecting that we're spending that all in fiscal year 12.
Mr. Jenke, I guess you lost me there. What are you going to spend it on?
Madam Chair, there's a number of different projects in that those funds were specifically set aside for. Maybe Mr. DeFebri can tell you specifically. Otherwise, we can get back to you with the specifics on those projects.
And Madam Chair, I believe that the lion's share of that is the REPI program, the Renewable Energy Production Incentive Program.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. DeFebri.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jeremy DeFebri, and I work in the Department of Commerce Office of Energy Security, and I'm feverishly trying to find the right piece of paper to answer your question.
We can always get back to us, too, with a list of those projects. That'd be fine.
I think I do have it relatively close at hand. If I turn it right, set up. I believe we're anticipating that we will continue to have within this budget. Did we same level certs as an anticipated? So that's 625 per fiscal year on RDF funding. We also are continuing, I think, into fiscal 12, having some of the automotive. Advanced automotive technology projects that have been active, I think, at Mankato State in particular, on research on both battery storage, I believe, and electronic car baseline performance data. And I think that that is the main. There are some, $22,000 here, $12,000 there, but those are the main chunks that that Tim's talking about. And I actually should, I hate to do this because I think I did this the last time, but I need to correct the deputy.
Please have at it. Grant.
The REPI funds actually do not flow through our office. We operate the program and on a monthly basis provide a notice to Xcel Energy on who to pay and how much. Okay. And they pay it directly.
Mr. Zafiri, if it's not too much problem, could you just kind of give us a breakdown of this special revenue fund, just as far as what the main projects are at some point, if you can get back to
Certainly.
Us?
Certainly. I mean, within that 8,160 FY12, 8,270 FY13, the largest chunks are about 500,000 in 11 and about 600,000 or 5 million in 11, 6 million in 12 that are SIP related. There is direct SIP activities, there's R&D, and some of that is new R&D grants, some of it is continued payment of active grants that are multi-year grants. And then there is also an annual transfer in each year to the University of Minnesota for Sustainable Buildings 2030 work. That's about the lion's share of it. There's also for the PBEAT program, there's approximately $1.3 million first year, $1.2 million second year for operations, delivery, and cash flow of that program. Mm-hmm.
A breakdown would be nice if you could. That'd be super. Thank you, Mr. DeFreeby.
Madam Chair, moving on to page 7 of the document. We've looked at kind of the general areas. This is as far as the pie charts before, giving you information here in a couple of different ways, trying to, I think everybody understands it a bit differently. So looking at this, basically we're looking at the general fund, we're looking at OES expenditures by fund and work unit. So trying to break down within the general fund which specific programmatic areas are using those dollars. You can see here, for instance, the general fund had about we're estimating $6.5 million in expenditures for the next biennium. Within that, you can see the energy regulation and planning, admin, and the state energy office are allocated to use some of that funding. And on down the line, I won't read them all here for you, but we have the federal funds, the ARA funding, and the special revenue fund. We put this together late, Madam Chair, so it's not included, but there's another single-page chart that the members, I think, should have. And this is really looking at a comparison from year to year, or actually biennium to biennium, looking at actuals from fiscal year 10 and budgeted amounts for fiscal year 11. So if members can kind of look across these two charts to see spending in the general fund is going down about 24.3% over the biennium. Primarily because in the general fund there was about $2.6 million of one-time funding in the last biennium, in the fiscal 10-11 biennium for E85 pump grants and Rock 10, the steam producing facility. That's not the total funding for those, the 2.6, but that's what's shown in the 10 and 11, in the 10 and 11 budget. As far as federal funds, they've stayed fairly constant. It's about a 1.1% decrease. The federal stabilization funds, obviously a very large decrease here over the two bienniums, about 78.8%. Obviously, those funds are being phased out in the coming biennium. And then the special revenue funds, the changes are noted there, about 2.6% decrease over the two bienniums. per in comparing the two bienniums.
Questions? Senator Howell.
Madam Chair, can you just speak a little bit more to the federal stabilization? You know, that's a pretty significant change there.
Mr. DeFebri.
Madam Chair, Senator Howell, the ERA funds were very significant impact on our office. We received $132 million for weatherization program and $54 million for the state energy program and approximately 10.6 for the energy efficiency and conservation block grant. That is in the unit I work in, the state energy office, has been the bulk of the work that we have done over the past 2 years has been related to stimulus. We did hire approximately 20 temporary unclassified employees to move that work forward, most of those in the weatherization program. As that winds down, that's presenting some both ramp down problems for us and for CAP agencies that have had to ramp up significantly to deliver weatherization services, and also for contractors that have had some significant employment and significant job opportunities through that. One of the advantages that we are having at this time of transition is that, as Dr. Haar had said, he has an aging shop, and to a certain extent, with the exception of me, we do also. We have three people in OAS that are taking early retirement over the next 4 months, but we have the potential to use some of these folks that we have had on staff through the stimulus to essentially backfill and bring new blood into those positions, and I think that's a key sort of to our boomer transition, is that we've been over the past 10 years or so we've not stayed quite as gray as PUC, so we have a better mix and we have some opportunity.
Don't take offense.
And calling Dr. Haar gray is actually a compliment. I think. But we have an opportunity that a challenge that also presents an opportunity with the ERA funds. I think that's where we have some very good employees that we'd like to keep. But another part of that is that how do we deal with the loss of jobs that's occurring in the CAP agencies and with contractors in particular, where there was significant employment, and we are working on looking at, are there other particularly short-term gap financing that we can do for some residential retrofit, but more importantly, long-term, how do we leverage private finance to get deeper into the residential retrofit market?
Senator Howell.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. To that extent, any more discussion about PACE bonds at all? I know we ran into an issue there with some of the, mortgage issues on Fannie Mae issues, but just wondering if you could speak to that.
Mr. DeFebri.
Madam Chair, yes, there are still those that think that PACE is viable. I'm not one of them. Under the current circumstances, I don't think that we certainly are not going to see residential PACE in a primary lien position, and that is the main value of it, is the primary lien position. I think there are other approaches one can take to residential financing, but it's going to require probably loss reserves to attract private financing into a subordinate position.
Okay. Senator Stump.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, under the energy assistance program, there's a significant amount of money in that area. What kind of strings are attached to that money, and how exactly does it? Can we leverage it in any way to, as we see the energy market going up?
Madam Chair, we're going to have the manager of that unit, John Hervanko, address that question, if you could.
Welcome, Mr. Hervanko.
Hello, Madam Chair. John Hervanko, State Director for the Energy Assistance Program. That is a federally funded program that requires us to follow the allowable activities under that federal grant, which includes primarily helping low-income homes pay energy bills.
Madam Chair, I was just wondering, like, you know, if you bought a gallon of fuel oil for a home or a cubic thermal of natural gas, let's say a month ago, and you bought it a month from now, I mean, the price differential might be double, or maybe not double, but a third more. So I'm just wondering, do we just get a carte blanche, $330 million, and they say kind of spend it as you see fit, or can you pre-purchase? What kind of flexibility do you have?
Mr. Hervanko.
Madam Chair, Senator, there is some flexibility as long as we follow the federal regulations on that. It is a drawdown process with federal funds. That we need to expend the funds, and then we draw it down on a daily basis.
So, Madam Chair, with that type of a system, you can't negotiate with distributors or wholesalers?
Mr. Hervanko.
Madam Chair, Senator, the bulk heating source in this state is natural gas. Over 70% of our households heat with natural gas. That's a regulated industry. So we wouldn't have any role in negotiating a price with those that energy source. We do have a role with that energy source negotiating terms and payment plans. For the remaining delivered fuels, there is some room for negotiations, and our local agencies do that on a regular basis. It's not so often with the price per gallon because it's extremely volatile over year to year, month to month. It's extraordinarily volatile pricing, and it's highly risky with public resources to enter into a pre-buy type of a program. But we are able to negotiate other service costs, delivery charges, and other special costs.
Thank you.
Senator Stump, I had carried several bills dealing with the assistance and delivered fuels, and it's a whole nother world out there when it comes to that and the market and trying to do pre-buy, and it's fascinating.
Madam Chair, I was just thinking about, you know, the agriculture does a lot of, you know, I mean, most of the inputs are actually bought before they ever go into the season, and it seems like it would be advantageous if we could figure out a way to, you know, take that amount of money and pre-purchase somehow to maximize the you'd get more for your dollar.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's right. This probably would be a good time too to recognize the federal dollars for LIHEAP and what's happening. If you want to tell the committee the bad news,
Madam Chair,
Director Grant, tell us the bad news.
Well, yeah. Why do I have to deliver the bad news?
The big dog now.
Thanks. I knew there was a downside. The president's budget proposal would call for a rather dramatic cut in LIHEAP funding for the next year, this is obviously of great concern to us. We've taken a look at what the impact would be on funding here in Minnesota. It would cut total amount of assistance dollars available by about half, and that would have obviously severe impacts not only on elderly and low-income residents of the state who depend on these funds to help them get through the winter, but also on our energy suppliers who really depend on that money to keep down arrearage levels on their own books. So this is obviously a matter of real concern. We've Certainly been working with the governor's office to make him aware of the problem, and are also working to communicate our concerns about the proposal to Minnesota's congressional delegation.
Thank you. Thank you. That is a very big concern. And Senator Dibble, I am so sorry. I know you had your hand up, and it was right after Senator Stump. Anything?
Oh, Madam Chair, my points were eloquently made by the Senator.
Okay.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, just and Mr. Hrebenko reminds me, of course, the federal budget for this year and next haven't been done yet, so this is not something that's locked in stone yet. We're still a long way to go before it. So
right, keep right. Your fingers crossed.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
Super. Any other questions on that part? Okay.
Madam Chair, moving on to page 8 of 10. This is a different way to view the same spending that we viewed on the last two slides. We're still at the total spending levels of just over $420 million for the biennium. But this is trying to look at more specifically, where do OES funds go? What type of services, what type of things are being purchased with the funding? You can see the first grouping here is the compensation, and that's split out by work unit. So you can see specifically energy regulation and planning includes just over $4.1 million. Again, I won't read these, but for the compensation, you'll note the FTE levels over here for fiscal 12 and 13, we're at about 76 and then down to 65. Primarily, that's the result of the loss of those temporary unclassifieds that Mr. DeFebre discussed earlier for the ARA funding. So those levels get down to in the neighborhood of where we were historically prior to any ARA funding. And it's inclusive of the governor's change request, which we'll get to in just in the next page here. On down to the next group of costs here are basically admin and internal costs, those types of things like rent, supplies, utilities, all that type of stuff. We have contracted services and then pass-through monies. And I think that's really the big piece of this is to look at is the funds that come through as pass-through or grants to local units of government, local assistance, really is the bulk of the funding at over $388 million. So you see that, that's primarily the energy assistance and all of the other federal funds that are administered in OES.
And finally, Madam Chair, the last page before the question page, if there is one, it's the governor's change item, and this really, if you want to just replay Dr. Haar's testimony here, I think you could do the same for us. What we're requesting is an increase in the general fund appropriation of $265,000 per year. This will be money collected through assessments against the utilities for actual dockets that we participate in that they're bringing to the Public Utilities Commission. So with that, there's no net impact to the general fund, but it provides us with three additional full-time equivalents, which are desperately needed to manage the workload that Dr. Haar described in the areas that we're seeing. And I think the real driver for a lot of that is the fact that the utility industry has gone a couple of decades without significant investment in infrastructure upgrades, and we're at the front end of a fairly robust period of those kinds of investments now going forward. And I think this is going to be a fact of life that we're going to be dealing with for the next several years at least as this new round of investment flows through to customers' rates.
And Director Grant, could you explain what's being proposed to perhaps mitigate or minimize some of all these filings and how the process could run a little bit more smoothly?
Madam Chair, we're always looking at ways to streamline the process to make sure that we're dealing as efficiently as possible. As Dr. Haar explained, we're doing so with, compared to other states, a very lean and mean staffing level. We do have a proposal that we're evaluating that Xcel Energy is bringing this year. I believe it's Senator Benson's proposal to look at a multi-year look at rates rather than a single year is the way we're doing it now, which we hope will reduce the frequency of rate case filings and lighten the workload some. Although until we go through at least a couple of these processes, I don't think we're making any promises about reductions in workload, but we're certainly hopeful that that will be one of the outcomes.
Senator Chungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Grant, I think what I just heard, so I want to qualify what you said, because if you increase a general fund appropriation and then you assess that back to the utilities, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy of becoming before the PUC for more and more rate cases because there's a new assessment which may affect the ratepayers and obviously the utilities. So I think we need what you just kind of said was we need to look at a multi-year if we're going to keep from having these constant rate cases filed. Is that, am I missing something in this circular logic motion here?
Madam Chair and Senator Youngbauer, I don't think that I meant to imply that there's a built-in incentive to bring more rate cases as a result of our assessment authority. In fact, of course, it's the utilities that propose rate increases, not the agency or the Public Utilities Commission. So we're in a responsive mode to what the utilities are filing. The reason that the utilities are having to come before us more frequently is that they're trying to flow more capital costs for these investments that they're making through rates, and they're not able to recover the full share of those capital costs with a single year look at future costs.
Senator, thank you, Madam Chair,
and Mr. Grant. So then, just trying to think logically through this, but if you're asking for more money, and that would be assessed against the utilities, can they not collect that back, or could that lead to a new rate case in order to recapture that new assessment? So you have to add more staff. So I'm trying to follow this logically, members, so we can see how it goes. If there's new staff requirements in order to handle all the rate case or filings, and then you need to have this increased assessment against the utilities, it could lead to a further rate case increase. Am I not following that logically, or?
Director.
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Youngbauer, I think what you need to bear in mind is that the amount of money that we're talking about here is not what's driving utilities to come forward with new rate cases. This is a tiny, tiny fraction of total rates for most utilities. And so the amount that's being assessed is not the driver for a new rate case.
And that's what I need to understand. Thank you.
Great.
So any great big tall poles.
Any other questions? Mr. Janke and Director Grant.
Your hand.
You guys are confusing me up here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Appreciate your overview and for everybody else, too. Members, we are doing our MISO tour Tuesday, so be looking for some information coming from Mr. Mavis about directions and what time, and if you want a carpool or something like that, that'd be great. And with that, the meeting is adjourned.